CGM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CGM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CGM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CGM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA Windsor on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Carla Lozano McCormick will be telling us a little bit about Champ One. So, can you tell me a bit about Champ One?
So I can tell you some my knowledge as the mom of the Champ One. My son is 2, and he was diagnosed when he was like about 15 months. And we had obviously never heard of that. We had never, it was in our thoughts that he would, you know, even have anything like this. And our geneticists, our doctors, have actually never heard of it either. So a CHAMP is there's very different, many different forms of CHAMP that can come. You can have it de novo, which is like, you know, you kind of, it creates itself on your body. It's not something he inherited from us. Or it can be inherited from a parent if they carry that gene, if it's dormant. My husband and I were DNA tested, and we actually do not have that. Those are the two ways that you can get it, and it's a deletion. It can be a deletion or a stop codon of the gene. My son has a stop codon of the gene. He does not have a deletion. Like many sort of the rare ones, they all kind of share a similar sort of symptoms. The ones that are most likely are like global delays is kind of what it falls down to. But it's a missing protein on the 13th, I believe, the 13th genome. When it goes into the science, I'm not the best at it. I'm still trying to wrap my brain around it. There's not a much to learn from it, but what there is, it's very limited.
So, as a parent, can you tell me a little bit about how you coped with the diagnosis and having to investigate, obviously, as to what you were dealing with?
Sure. So, when my son was born, at 36 weeks. He was to be a scheduled C-section, but he actually came 2 weeks before his scheduled C-section. So he was a tiny little guy right from birth. He was like 5 pounds, 15 ounces. And for me, the minute they gave me my son, I think just as a mom's intuition, like they just, something was off. He was different. I have an older child, and every child is different, but at the same time, it just was so different. And internally, I just thought like, oh, there's something not okay. He didn't latch right away. Everything was just different from my other one. And again, knowing that every child is different, they still should share some things, you know? He was a little guy. He was 5 pounds, 15 ounces. So therefore, like all the metrics would sort of also be kind of smaller, like his head range. He, in the end, we ended up finding out that he had microcephaly, but when he was born, his little head range kind of fit for how small he was. So at birth, they were, you know, he sort of passed everything, and we, you know, we were in a hospital. He had a whole NICU team because he was born so early, but he never was in the NICU. You know, he stayed with me. So he passed all his markers. There was one thing right away, though, for him, is that he failed his hearing tests in the hospital, and then he failed it again when we went into the public health here in Canada. And you know, we did the testing there, and then he got forwarded on to, like, the, you know, the big test where it's like, you know, 3 hours, 4 hours, and he passed it at that time. But by that point, from birth until he did that testing, it had been like about almost 2 months. Now, hindsight 2020, we know that because CHAMP is a global delayed, like, his hearing was just delayed, hence why he failed it. You know, he just wasn't, he hadn't developed his hearing fully, and now he's fine. He has no hearing issues, but that was our first marker. And then I think when he was like 3 months, he still kind of wasn't holding his head up. When he was about, you know, 6 months, again, I have an older child, by 6 months he was sitting. My son Zane was not. And all of those things were just like, I kept going to his doctors and saying, you know, like, he's just really behind. He's not doing all of the things that he should be doing, or that a baby this age should be doing. And I was just dismissed as, you know, oh, you know, he'll catch up. There's a big range. Some kids, you know, just, you know, like, they do it later, or, but I just knew. I knew that there was something that we needed to look at. And then finally, when he was about 9 months, so he didn't sit until he was 9 months, like, and that was just sort of, he still needed assistance, but he didn't sit, you know, independently until he was a little bit older. And then finally, I pushed, like, I was okay, you know, like, even family was like, you know, like, just give him time, babies will get there. And my general doctor, like, his general doctor, begrudgingly referred me to a pediatrician. He said, you know, I don't see any red flags, but moms tend to be a bit hysterical. So, word for word, what he told me. He said, you know, moms tends to be a little bit more hysterical, you know, about babies. So, I'll put in, you know, like, to refer you to a pediatrician. But so that was when he was almost one. I was finally referred to a pediatrician. But even when I got to the pediatrician, I thought maybe he was autistic, because why would I ever think that my son had, like, a rare, you know, genetic disorder? I thought, you know, maybe he's autistic. Maybe that's what we're looking at. And I had, like, he had a whole physical with the pediatrician. From head to toe, it was about an hour and a half. And at the very end of it, I asked her point blank. I said, is there something wrong with him? And I apologize for the wording, because, you know, again, now, like, you, yeah. I wouldn't say that. But at the moment, that's just kind of what you think of. And she just looked at me right in the eyes, and she said, no, there's nothing wrong with him. You just, you know, need to realize that you had two different children, and he'll catch up. And then she kind of, you know, patted me on the back, and she said, I think this appointment was more for mom than it was for Bubs.
So,
and then she asked if I wanted to, if I had looked into therapy, into postpartum depression and all that stuff for me. So again, you know, it was not like, yeah, there's something wrong with your baby, even though he's not meeting his markers, he's not over here. It was more like, what's wrong with you as the parent? Like, why do you keep asking all these questions? So it took for me just pushing and pushing to finally get a diagnosis. And he was actually, he is the youngest of his specific deviation for CHAMP 1, because I just got him in so quick.
So, do you have any advice for any parents out there who might be struggling with the same question of, should I keep going, or is the doctor
yes.
right?
Yes, because the doctors just, you know, they don't know everything. You know, we think at least my thought was, well, the doctors know, you know, and I took such comfort after that meeting with the pediatrician that she told me that there was nothing wrong, you know, for like about a week or 2 weeks, I would say, I lived in that cloud of like, well, she said there's nothing wrong. And she's the doctor. I mean, she's not even like his general doctor. She's the pediatrician, you know, she knows more. And, you know, she has told me that there's nothing wrong. So I lived in that cloud for about 2 weeks, but deep down inside, just as a parent, you just know, you know, you know your kids best more than anybody else because you're with them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So if there is something that just doesn't feel okay, just keep pushing. Someone eventually, you know, will listen and will help you. And that's exactly, you know, we ended up one night after Googling what was available in my community, I ended up coming across something called Kids Inclusive here in Kingston, and I called them. I mean, their website is like, you know, you have to be referred by a doctor, but I just called as a mom, and I think the person intaking, she said, you know, like, you're supposed to be referred into this program by a doctor, and I think she just heard the, like, absolute desperation. I had gone to doctors, I had, you know, and I just kept being told it was me. And she was nice enough to say, you know what, like, I'm just going to put your referral in. And then I went to see, I thought maybe he just needed like physiotherapy because my son was not like I said, he wasn't walking. He wasn't like sitting. He wasn't rolling. Like his left side was very weak. And it took that physiotherapist to do an assessment on him and say, Mom, there is something here. And she's the one that then from, you know, on her side, pushed and pushed and pushed, that we ended up getting his awesome team that we have now. But it was because of her. And so it just takes one person to sort of, you know, if you keep pushing, you find that one person that will hear you. So just listen to your gut and keep pushing.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. Thanks.
In this segment of our show, Todd Davenport
and Stacy Stevens
will be telling us a little bit about the Workwell Foundation.
So, can you tell me a little bit about the Workwell Foundation?
Well, the Workwell Foundation's mission is to study and research the functional aspects of ME/CFS and long COVID, particularly related to the symptom of post-exertional malaise and characterizing fatigue, and then to help those folks live their lives better.
So, how are you reaching out to the affected population to let them know that you're trying to gain a better understanding and offer support?
Well, we do several, we have several educational projects going. Todd, can you talk a little bit about our presentations to the physical therapy community?
Yeah, so in thinking about presenting to the clinical community, I'm a physical therapist by training. And as a physical therapist, we've gone to the physical therapy meetings to discuss our findings with respect to exercise and cautions with exercise, the need for pacing to the physical therapy groups, the American Physical Therapy Association. We have an upcoming talk with the California Physical Therapy Association, so a lot of the big groups. And we've done both synchronous in-person as well as asynchronous webinars that have been pretty well received. We've also done a lot of speaking with other groups around the country, around the world, related to how our findings relate to long COVID and relate to ME/CFS. So starting a new educational venture through Workwell Health, which is going to be a learning community for clinicians and for patients who are interested in learning more about their condition, involving chat groups, short video clips of explaining key concepts, and also courses for clinicians, webinar-based courses for clinicians coming forward.
So I'm curious, with long COVID and any other condition you're working on, have you encountered any myths or misperceptions about them?
Absolutely. I think the biggest myth in our fields, I'm an exercise physiologist, exercise is medicine. And we're really passionate about exercise education because exercise in these populations, in people with post-exertion symptom exacerbation, is toxic. And so that really is a focus of our research and our educational efforts.
So,
and you know, just to...
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, I just totally stepped on you there.
Sorry.
Just to add to that, one of my favorite myths to break is this whole notion of fatigue, in terms of chronic fatigue syndrome. As a researcher and as a clinician, people often ask me what my interest is, and I let them know that I research this condition called chronic fatigue syndrome, and they go, oh, thank you for your service because I get tired too. so I have a coffee and I have a nap and I'm fine. And of course, this is not that. So my favorite myth to bust is that we use fatigue as a placeholder for post-exertional malaise, which is a multi-system, multi-sign condition that is terribly disabling. And fatigue just doesn't cover it. The fatigue of post-exertional malaise is this feeling of being bonked or having nothing left in the tank. So very, very different use of the word than I think most people think about it on a daily basis.
So, in your time with the Work Well Foundation, has there been any success moment that stands out for each of you?
Well, I think this last meeting we had at the American Physical Therapy Association, we talked about how to care for people with long COVID. We've been doing this for over a decade. We started with MECFS, myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, and we had a handful of people show up. At this last meeting, essentially highly similar content for the long COVID population, the room was packed, probably had an attendance of 700. So all of a sudden, people are really interested in our work, and we've been saying the same things for 20 years. So, I think that was certainly a high point for me.
And certainly there's those big scale efforts where, the impact is obvious, but I have to say that my true wins, my true victories are smaller and they involve individual patients. Stacey and I have the opportunity to consult with individual patients, in our dealings with folks, and just sharing simple things that can begin to help. Really can help change lives. Of course, there's no FDA approved medication or treatment for long COVID or myalgic encephalomyelitis. There's no cure, so to speak, yet. But simple things in terms of implementing energy conservation ideas into a person's life really can start to turn a condition that is terribly isolating, terribly disabling, and terribly unpredictable into something that feels a little more manageable.
So, do you find it?
I agree completely with Todd. Let me just add, when we see patients for disability evaluation, their family members, their medical providers don't believe that they're impaired. And they are told they're lazy and crazy, and they come to us for objective cardiopulmonary exercise testing, and we can tell them, you have metabolic dysfunction, cardiovascular dysfunction, pulmonary dysfunction that limits your ability to produce energy and do work day in and day out. It's really validating and rewarding to see those patients understand their limitations and get their disability as a result.
Like, thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
You bet.
Thanks. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
So you're hanging with your inner circle. Maybe you're making cocktails. Maybe you're packing bowls. Even while we're distancing, it's important to remember, alcohol and cannabis each mess with your driving skills. Be cool. Make sure you and your friends get home safe. Take a cab if you need to. A few bucks could save a life. and we can do it again next weekend. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Sober.
Sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA Windsor on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Carla Lozano McCormick told us a little bit about Champ 1, and Todd Davenport and Stacy Stevens told us a little bit about Workwell.
In this segment of our show, Ariel Maharaj will be telling us a little bit about NEDIC.
So, can you tell me a little about NEDIC?
Yeah, we're the National Eating Disorder Information Center, or NEDIC. We are a registered Canadian charity that was founded in 1985 and is a program of the University Health Network's Center for Mental Health. We operate a nationwide toll-free telephone helpline and an online live chat service that's available anonymously and confidentially for anyone across the country who feels like they're struggling with eating and body image. It's a helpline specific for eating disorders in the way that we talk about it, but no diagnosis or like medical situation is necessary. We've talked with people who are as young as 8 or 9 who are noticing a friend getting teased, to people much older in their life who maybe had a diagnosed eating disorder and been struggling for a really long time. It's by virtue of it being anonymous and confidential, there really isn't a lot of personal health information we collect. We're really kind of here to be the in-the-moment support for you, be able to potentially guide folks to resources, information that can help them take the next best step that they need. And if they are looking for more different kinds of supports, hospital, community, etc., where we have a database of eating disorder-informed providers to help make those connections, because we know right now those referrals right now aren't always warm, and we try to do that.
So, in your work, do you ever encounter any myths or misperceptions concerning eating disorders?
All the time, every single day. I wish that I didn't, but I can also get it, just given how much, like, we all have a body, we all have a relationship with food and eating and movement, and so therefore, I think there is probably 8 billion opinions on those sorts of things, and therefore, I think myths, there's the ripe environment for them to foster. Most regularly, I think one of the ones that I hear the most is folks thinking that eating disorders only affect a certain type of person, often like a someone who is in a smaller body and potentially upper middle class and white and identifying as a woman. And while I think that's the story that is often told about eating disorders and maybe the mental picture of who people think of when they hear the word eating disorder, I really want to send the message that eating disorders are as diverse as the people that they affect. And really there are many different types and anyone in any body size of any gender or race or socioeconomic status can be impacted by it.
So, through your education efforts, people call for support. I take it you offer fact as opposed to fiction, just to help guide people as to the realities of their situation.
Yeah, and it's always a sensitive conversation, right? Because I think when people come in with information that they think is true, it can sometimes be jarring or maybe feel kind of rejected or maybe a little bit fighty if potentially they think that what we're saying is false. I think we always try really hard to not get into an argument or to be refuting a client's opinion or a service user's opinion. We more so want to get to, like, where did they learn it and who told that to them. So, for instance, like, there are lots of folks who might have reached out because they're saying that, like, a friend or a family member was worried about them, but they feel like everything is okay. They don't think they're struggling because restricting their eating and losing weight is something that was really helpful for them. They're feeling more validated in their body that they're in now. So how could this be bad? How could this be an illness? And I think while we're all fact in that instance might be making sure that that person were trying to understand and validate the context in which they were treated in when they were in a different body, when they were potentially larger, or some of the hurt and the shame that they might have felt before thinking that they needed to potentially restrict, is a conversation that we'll have instead of just fully providing psychoed or information about it. That might come really gently through a conversation as we got to understand their story a little bit more.
So, in your time with NEDIC, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Yeah, it's really nice to have this question, because I feel like so often, probably like many other mental health services or for folks working in disability justice and disability communities, I think so often it just feels like everything's on fire and there's crisis after crisis, and I feel like I'm really adept firefighter now, even though I'd much rather be a construction worker. I'd really much rather be building houses with non-flammable material. And one example of that, I think, recently is we had a chance funding through the Slate Family Foundation to get to put resources together for people who are Black, Indigenous, or people of color by community for community. So really, we had money to compensate people for their time, got to recruit folks with lived experience and professional experience across the country, getting to work together to create a resource to enhance visibility for community members who are like them. And we've ended up now with 6 different community member resources for Black folks, for Indigenous folks, for East and Southeast Asian folks, for Latin folks, South Asian folks, and Middle Eastern folks, and also got to put together a guidance for healthcare providers on how to potentially practice support for people with eating disorders from a place of cultural sensitivity and cultural humility. Those guys were kind of just released, I think, in February, March, just recently. And I think it's been a highlight just because of how often those stories aren't told and how often I think there's gaps in training and knowledge about those sorts of intersections. So we're happy for them to maybe be part of a solution.
So if you could send any message to the community about why such guides are important and why we should keep different perspectives on eating disorders, different cultural backgrounds in focus, what would you say?
Yeah, I think folks might be surprised to learn that for many folks who are currently practicing in healthcare in Canada, receive very little training about eating disorders, even though it is a really serious, severe experience someone might be going through. For instance, a survey in 2014 of Canadian medical residents found that 70% of them got less than 5 hours of training on eating disorders over the course of their education. So even for a listener listening to this 10, 15 minutes, doesn't mean now we're suddenly like 1/18th a doctor or something like that, but let that speak to just how little information that someone might actually be getting about something I think really severe. And so I think guides like this from a place of non-blame are just helping equip people who are in the field to be able to respond in a way that they can feel that they're more confident or maybe even more comfortable doing. Getting to understand and unpack what does trauma-informed practice look like for eating disorders. I think we throw around these buzzwords around trauma-informed or cultural sensitivity without necessarily going into what they mean or how might they apply. And in these guides, I think we had the chance through these vignettes by community members to really give life and speak to those stories, which to us, I think, was really, really important.
Mike, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sounds good.
Thanks. My friends, again, I'm left with the eternal question, why? Why is it when it comes to things like eating disorders or mental health concerns, we put up this stigma, this barrier? Is it because a disability of more physical nature, something we can more readily process or relate to? Might be. The fact is, for the person affected, it's no less real, it's no less impactful, and they need just as much understanding and support as anyone else. For the fact is, a person with any type of disability, given the right tools at the right moment, can achieve great things. However, it's very true, no one in this world gets by all on their own. So, the question is,
how can we have compassion for someone who has, say, an amputation, has lost a limb, look at someone with a mental health concern and say, oh, I don't want to deal with that? Is it because it's not something we're as familiar with? Honestly, that's where it's incumbent upon each one of us to get ourselves better educated. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.